Fake News, the 1968 edition, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Trump is not the first president to blame his troubles on the press. Listen to LBJ back in 1968.
The press is lying like drunken sailors every day.
The context, the Vietnam War, and the Tet Offensive launched 50 years ago today. This Vietnamese survivor remembers it clearly.
And I think of the ghosts living in the trees. I think of the graves. And I can't go there because the spirit is there. That whole sadness is there with me.
Plus, a different kind of memory, English singer James Hunter on his love of soul music.
I love soul. I've always loved it. I really do. And I used to listen to a lot of that stuff when I was a kid growing up.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thanks for being with us today. When President Donald Trump delivers his first State of the Union address tonight, he'll take to the podium amid all kind of news concerning Russia. There is the hacking, the possible collusion, and the Trump White House just released a list of Russian politicians and wealthy oligarchs, people who are believed to be profiting from their connections to Vladimir Putin, and they could be facing sanctions. It's a list, by the way, that apparently is the same one that Forbes magazine released last year, their list of the 200 richest businessmen in Russia 2017. But here's the main thing you need to know about the White House's Russia list. Congress voted overwhelmingly to apply sanctions to Russia, not just talk about it. So we'll see what Trump says about all that tonight. But since we're The World, we want to hear how the publication of this list is going down in Russia. For that, let's turn to reporter Charles Maines in Moscow. He says, except for Vladimir Putin, the list encompasses most of Russia's political and economic elite.
Essentially, we're talking about all of Russia's top oligarchs, the entire presidential administration. We're talking about top governors, mayors, people who are involved in state entities. And in terms of the purpose, you know, I think that that really gets to – it's a bit of a mystery. On the one hand, the Treasury Department in the U.S. said, you know, explicitly that the vast majority of these Russians on this list were not subject to sanctions. But the registry's very existence is seen by others as really a veiled threat for possible future sanctions.
And what did you have to have done to get on this list?
Well, you know, they haven't really been explicit about the criteria. I mean, they're identified as people that are close to President Putin, close to the Russian regime, or the Kremlin regime. And, you know, of course, this is part of this wider web of sanctions imposed by the U.S. on Russia over a variety of issues. It's not only the election hacking or the alleged election hacking, as they like to say here, but also human rights abuses in Russia, as well as Russia's actions in Ukraine.
Mm. So how has the Kremlin responded? Do they see this as just naming and shaming?
Earlier in the day, we heard from Putin's spokesman, Dmitry Peskov. He said essentially this was labeling everyone on that list an enemy of the U.S. But we also heard from Vladimir Putin. He was actually at a campaign event. Russia's getting ready for presidential elections in March. He was asked about this by a supporter who said, you know, how can I get on this list as well? Because it's sort of a sign of pride here that you're a patriot. And Putin, you know, said this was an act that was, you know, essentially targeted against all Russians. He said this was basically sanctioning 146 million Russians, the entire population of the country.
Now, some of the people named on this list, as you indicated earlier, Charles, are already subject to sanctions. But the list doesn't imply any new punishments, correct?
That's right. But, you know, again, I mean, what is the point of this? I mean, part of the backdrop to this whole process is, of course, that you know, we have Congress who forced these sanctions on the White House. I think it was pretty clear that Donald Trump was not all that excited to sign this into law, but it was passed overwhelmingly by Congress, so he didn't really have a choice. And, you know, if even if you look at the way this list was produced by the White House, they provided it 10 minutes before midnight on the last day. So, you know, it's kind of like turning your homework in at the last second.
Yeah. Are some of the people on this list worried that maybe their shopping trips to Fifth Avenue may be curtailed?
Well, exactly. And one of the other parts of it that we don't know is that there is the public portion of the list and there's the classified portion of the list. And the thought is that while we have this kind of blanket list of 210 Russian individuals, again, most of them from the world of politics and business, they're, of course, their families, their wives, their children. So, you know, as much as they can laugh off these sanctions here and this list, which many people did today, I think there is concern that, you know, certainly nobody wants to be on them if they don't have to.
Charles Maines in Moscow, thank you as always.
Thank you.
I think I just saw a Russian shopping on Fifth Avenue just last week. So Russians shop on Fifth Avenue all the time.
That's reporter Natalia Antonova, former editor for the Moscow News. She recently returned to the U.S. after a decade abroad. And now that she's back, Russian expat shopping habits aren't the only thing she's keeping an eye on. Antonova says she's struck by how much credit Americans give Vladimir Putin, credit she says he doesn't deserve.
We build him up to be this invincible Bond villain and amazing chess player and strategist. And he's really none of these things. He hasn't given Russia any kind of new national idea since he came on board. He's been very good about enriching his circle of friends as a way to ensure loyalty and compliance. But, you know, it doesn't take a genius to do that.
But he's got staying power. I mean, he's basically held power since Boris Yeltsin handed the baton to him. So he's got something. He may not be a Bond villain, but...
Well, he's got something in the sense that, you know, we also have to understand that Russia had a broken political system before he came on the scene. He exploited that, and he had people next to him who were very happy to help him exploit that. You know, he was a realist when it came to Russia's political system and how it all works. Because, you know, just to remind our listeners, Russia has never had a stable working democracy. Not really. You know, what was happening under Yeltsin was a farce, not a stable working democracy.
So we know the misperceptions of Putin here in the States. What else has struck you since you've gotten to the States about how the U.S. sees Russia?
So a lot of people actually still stuck in the past, and they kind of conflate Russia with the Soviet Union, the superpower. And I want to go, hello, guys. The Soviet Union's done. Russia's not a superpower. Russia internally, internally in Russia, in the Russian Federation, there's a lot of tension. Who knows what will happen and whether or not that tension will explode when Putin goes, you know, because Putin's not immortal here. You know, like, let's remember that, you know, he's not some immortal vampire who's going to rule this country for the next 100 years. No, that's not going to happen.
And looking at the United States with those same eyes, what strikes you about how Russians see the United States?
I mean, in some ways, I feel that Russians are more realistic about the States. There's quite a bit of resentment of our military power. We're seen as interfering all over the world, you know what I mean? So that's a big issue for Russians. I think Russians are still very much upset that, you know, when they threw off Soviet rule, they thought they had ended this authoritarian system. And then to have Americans laugh in their faces and be like, haha, we beat you in the Cold War, it was like not a good mood. Like American triumphalism really messed things up, I feel like, in the 90s. And I would also say that a lot of Russians have like a House of Cards perception of America. You know, Putin is said to be a fan of House of Cards. And apparently he's rumored to actually believe that this is how Washington actually works.
What do you think Russians will make of a post-Kevin Spacey House of Cards?
What are we all going to make of it? I'm interested. I'm interested to see the reaction in Russia, because I feel like Robin Wright is really going to take center stage. And will this find a positive audience in Russia? I don't know. We'll have to see. We'll have to wait and see.
Natalia, I know you have a young son. Can I ask how old he is?
He's 6.
Can I ask you about his impressions of life in Russia versus life in the U.S.? Has he had any observations?
Well, he was supposed to go to school at 7 years old in Moscow. But then we left, and obviously we're in New York, where kids go to school at 6. So he was very scared of public school at first, because he just kind of had an image of what it's like in Moscow with public schools, where it's kind of, you know, maybe the teachers will be mean to you, they're very strict, there's lots of homework. And then he went to public school here, and he loves it because actually people are really nice. So that was like a pleasant surprise for him, I think.
Are there things your kid misses about Russia?
He misses the Moscow metro, because the subway in New York is a bit of a disappointment and a letdown. Because in Moscow, of course, the Moscow metro is reliable, it's beautiful, it's very accessible. And like when you're standing there at the platform on the subway in New York and like it's been 10 minutes, a child gets very confused by that. He's like, well, how does this even work? You know, how do New Yorkers get to work? And I'm like, they're frequently late.
Yeah, watch the closing doors when they arrive. Natalia Antonova in New York, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We're waiting for President Trump to give his State of the Union speech tonight, but people in Liberia have already heard their new president give his. George Weah, former international soccer star, made some news by announcing he was cutting his pay by 25%. He also surprised many people by promising to get rid of what he called a racist law in the country's constitution. It's a part that states, quote, only persons who are Negroes or of Negro descent shall qualify by birth or by naturalization to be citizens, end quote. You have to remember that Liberia was founded by and for freed American slaves, and the country's founders wanted to distinguish between people who descended from American slaves and those who were native born. I asked journalist Umaru Fofana, who has reported extensively from Liberia, to explain.
The framers of the country's constitution had just freed themselves from slavery. So they thought that restricting citizenship to black or colored people and not people of white skin color would protect them against future enslavement, because Liberia was set up as a colony for freed slaves from the United States. And I'm quoting President Weah here. They, as freed slaves, were fleeing from the oppressive yoke of slavery imposed upon them by white slave owners. They therefore wanted Liberia to be a refuge and a haven for freed men of color. And so they restricted citizenship only to black people.
Yeah, I was going to ask you why specifically George Weah is acting on this part of the Constitution. Like, why didn't former President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf take it on?
We are not sure what has driven this, because it was never a campaign issue. When I interviewed him, I mean, a couple of times during the campaigns and in between the first round and the runoff election, whenever I asked him about what his priorities were, he never ever got anywhere near to addressing this citizenship conundrum. So the fact that he has made it is more or less his most important step to deal with now is something which is quite interesting. And I've spoken to some Liberians who do not seem to know why he has decided to make this such a very powerful priority at this stage in his very first, you know, literally first few days in office.
Do you have any hunches?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the Lebanese community in Liberia were very much prominent in the campaigning. There were rumors that they backed one side or the other, and that they backed the CDC party of George Weah. So possibly it's a quid pro quo, but there is no strong evidence citing that. But I wouldn't be surprised if this was, you know, pushed or moved by the fact that he wanted to consider those Liberians of Lebanese ancestry to make them feel good if they did support him.
What have you heard about reaction from Liberians to this change?
It's mixed. I've been on social media, I've been checking Liberia, and some of them are really even cussing the whole proposal, saying the law should be kept, should be maintained as it is. Others are saying that the country should move ahead and be like modern-day democracies, whereby citizenship is not guaranteed or determined by the color of someone's skin. But additionally, President Weah is also talking for dual citizenship. There are so many Liberians who are in the United States. Some good number of them went there during the country's civil war in the 1990s, but others had been there because of the history between the two countries. And the moment they became American citizens, their citizenship of Liberia was in question. And they are really supportive of that particular proposal that the president has put forward.
Historically, do you know any examples of non-blacks in Liberia who were expelled because of this law?
I am not sure. There was no clear expulsion order for anyone to leave the country if they were not native Liberians or black people. But clearly, they wouldn't become Liberians. They wouldn't. They couldn't go to the country's legislature. They couldn't go to the House of Representatives, nor could they go to the Senate, let alone run for president. So clearly, I mean, it's been something which people have not been kicked out for, as far as I know, but they felt really discriminated against by this provision, you know, in a country of their birth.
One last thing, Umaru, how many people could this affect?
We don't exactly have figures on how many people this affects as things stand, but I would definitely say that they are in their thousands. One Lebanese person that I spoke to said, it doesn't matter, even if there are only 5 of us, we were born here, therefore we should be allowed to be citizens of the country of our birth.
That's reporter Umaru Fofana. Later on the show, sharp memories from Hanoi of the Tet Offensive 50 years ago today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. Let's check in now with our 50 States Project. That's where we look at how communities around the U.S. are faring in an increasingly globalized world. Today, we're headed to Oklahoma, where cattle is big business, and it could be even bigger. At least that's what one Native American tribe in northeastern Oklahoma is betting on. Here's The World's Allison Herrera with the story.
Jason Reeves knows what good steak looks like before it hits the plate.
This cattle right here, I would say, obviously A bone, because it's right here. Like, your bone maturity is from A to E.
Reeves and I are standing in a freezer in this meat processing plant. Reeves is giving me a quick tutorial about identifying the inside of a cow.
That's the kidney, heart, fat on the inside. You're probably looking at a 2.0. You can tell it's good cattle.
The thing that makes this place special, it's the only USDA meat processing plant owned and operated by a Native American tribe. The Quapaw tribe in northeast Oklahoma opened this facility last fall, and Reeves is training to become the first Native American USDA meat grader.
I've always been around cattle. I grew up, my dad working on feedlots, so it's kind of inspired me to be around cattle my whole life. When I was given this opportunity to do this, it kind of opened my eyes, being the very first one ever in the United States.
That's a big deal here because there aren't many facilities in Oklahoma that have USDA grading and inspection on site. For Reeves, the opportunity means better pay, stable employment, and a chance to work for the tribe.
There's good jobs around here, but everyone strives to work for the tribes because of the benefits and stuff they have. And, I mean, they are good jobs.
For the tribe, it's a chance to grow the business into something that can provide better employment for people in the community, whether they're part of the tribe or not. Oklahoma currently ships a lot of its cattle to neighboring states like Texas, Colorado, and Kansas to be processed for sale. The tribe wants to expand this operation, and that would mean more jobs at the processing plant, more people helping to raise the cattle, and more folks to pack and ship that meat to stores. And that money staying in the state could help Oklahoma with its $600 million budget deficit. I meet the tribe's agricultural director, Chris Roper. He's a tall, stocky man with silver hair. He takes me on a tour to see their livestock.
We have a lot of property here. We don't necessarily keep all of our animals in a pen. We have animals that stay out on grass, in a field. These are all Angus.
The tribe owns 1,300 head of Angus cattle and 200 head of bison, all raised right here in Miami and processed at this facility.
The bison in front of us, they've been in here about 2 months now, and they'll be harvested here pretty soon.
Harvested, as in slaughtered. The operation is still relatively small. The Quapaw tribe have 13 full-time employees at this plant and a USDA inspector on site. But the designation means they can take in cattle from other ranches and make the meat grocery store ready right here. They're harvesting around 20 animals per week.
The facility will handle up to 200 a week as far as the growth curve we have.
That's good news to Oklahoma Secretary of Agriculture Jim Reese. He's pleased the Quapaw facility can take cattle from other ranches.
It's just an area where we have a need in Oklahoma. And, you know, it would be ideal if the Quapaw facility can show that this is a viable business.
The tribe has a number of viable businesses, not just this facility. It's one of the major employers in this part of the state, with its casinos, convenience stores, ranches, farms, and now a craft brewery. But the Quapaw's meat processing plant is also part of the tribe's larger strategy to raise their own cattle, grow their own vegetables, and move away from the unhealthy diet that's plagued Indian country for decades.
They're pretty, aren't they?
Jason Reeves wraps up his training in Nebraska in a couple of months to become a USDA-certified grader. He's here today for just a quick visit, but he's looking forward to coming home to Miami, being with his 5-year-old son, and doing the work he loves.
And the cool thing about it, I mean, I'll still take care of the cows and stuff. It's going to be a great deal, I think, because I'll be with them from the time they're born and from the time they leave. I mean, I'll have my hands in it.
For The World, Allison Herrera, Miami, Oklahoma.
Allison joins me now via Skype. So the Quapaws are a relatively small tribe in Oklahoma, but their interests seem really diverse. What kind of economic clout do Native American nations generally have in the state?
Well, Marco, tribes boast more than a $10 billion impact on the state of Oklahoma's economy. Oklahoma is home to 39 federally recognized tribes. One of the largest tribes in the United States and in the state of Oklahoma is the Cherokee Nation. They went from having $2 million in the bank when they reconstituted to now having $2 billion,
wow.
To having a $2 billion impact. And they have a number of businesses, not just casinos.
Yeah. Will casinos always be bankrolling these other economic projects, or is there kind of an intent to eventually kind of leave the casinos behind?
I think that tribes will use gambling revenue and gaming revenue to invest and support these other businesses. But I do think that there is an interest in investing in other businesses so that if revenue from gaming and casinos drops off, they have these other businesses.
Tell me about some of the other ventures that the tribes are involved in, specifically the Cherokee Nation.
They have a defense contract. They actually have a security company in Baghdad. They also, they're building a new multi-million dollar medical facility. They're building the facility, and the federal government is actually going to run that clinic.
So with all the wealth that the various tribes have built up in Oklahoma, what kind of relations with the state has that led to?
Well, Principal Chief Bill John Baker really likes to boast partnerships. And one of those partnerships is with the state. I don't think I mentioned that the state of Oklahoma is suffering from a very large budget deficit. And because of that budget deficit, they're not able to sometimes fix and repair roads in the manner that they would like. Here's Principal Chief Bill John Baker talking a little bit about that.
The county commissioners love us because many of the roads that are coming up in their districts that they don't have to grade anymore are roads that we put in. And there's never a sign that says Cherokee's only on this road. The road is for everybody. And so if you drive a car in northeastern Oklahoma, you cannot get anywhere without driving on a road that the Cherokee Nation has either built or helped build.
Allison, I got to say, the Cherokee, and as we heard in your story earlier, the Quapaws, they really seem to have their economic interests in control. How reproducible are these projects and results within other tribes and nations around the country? And what do you think the main impediments are to this happening more?
I could say that it's because they don't have the casino wealth to be able to invest in other businesses. And I think that's what makes Cherokee Nation unique. When Amazon was looking to build their new headquarters or their second headquarters, Cherokee Nation actually approached the city of Tulsa and said, okay, this is what we can offer in terms of incentives to be able to bring Amazon here. So we'll work with you to be able to try to lure this company to the state.
Yeah, is Tulsa still on the Amazon list?
No, it's not.
Well, it is in high demand by many cities around the country, so understandable. The World's Allison Herrera, thanks very much.
Thank you so much, Marco.
I'm Marco Werman. After multiple terror attacks in recent days, people in Kabul are putting pieces of paper in their pockets with all their personal information.
This is my coffin I'm carrying in my pocket because no one knows when a blast happens or when a suicide attacker came from behind you.
Little notes, just in case. That story still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. If it feels like Afghanistan has been in the headlines a lot lately, you're right. For the past 10 days, the capital Kabul has been targeted almost nonstop. I've got The World's Shirin Jafari here to bring us up to speed with what's going on there. Shirin, give us a sense of how bad it's been in Kabul lately.
Well, Marco, to put it simply, it's been out of control. Let me just quickly run through some of the attacks we've had recently. There was one at Intercontinental Hotel about 10 days ago. Taliban fighters took over the hotel for about 15 hours. Guests were trapped inside, and the attackers killed about 22 people before it was all over. Then last Saturday, a Taliban suicide bomber blew up an ambulance on a busy street in Kabul, and that blast killed about 100 people. Just one day after that, the Islamic State attacked a military training base and killed 11 soldiers.
Yeah.
So all that going on in the span of just a couple of days.
Yeah, it has been a horrible stretch. So how are people in Kabul reacting to this uptick in violence?
Well, I spoke to a couple of people in Kabul today, and they basically told me they're terrified. I mean, think of it. People don't even have time to bury their loved ones. They don't even have time to mourn the dead before another attack happens. And these attacks have really shaken people up because of a couple of reasons. First of all, they've targeted a lot of civilians. There seems to be no rhyme or reason as to where the attacks happen. And it's been happening one right after the other.
So the people that you spoke to in Kabul, what did they tell you about how they're just going about their days?
It's interesting, Marco. Since the attacks started happening, I noticed that there was this post going around on social media, and it said, staying alive in Kabul is an accident. So please consider putting these details on a piece of paper and in your pocket before you leave the house. your name, your father's name, phone number of a close relative, and your home address.
Wow, that's really eerie. So it's kind of like a in case I die type of note. But don't people in Kabul have like standard government IDs?
Yeah, they do. But a lot of those government IDs don't have details like, I don't know, your auntie's name or her phone number or your blood type, which is really important detail if you are caught up in one of these attacks. And I asked about this from Mujibullah Dastyar. He lives in Kabul. He's a photographer. And he told me he never thought about carrying a note like this before. That's until he lost a friend in one of the recent attacks, the one that happened in Kabul, and it involved an ambulance.
His name was Rabbi Jawadi. He was like 24 years old. He just went to cross the street, and the blast happened. When that happened, so he lost his life. And for the first hours or 2 hours, his body was lost, something. So everyone was posting in social media that he is missing.
Yeah, so his friend was missing, and Dasir said they finally managed to find the remains of his body. But it really hit him. This could happen to him at any point.
So I decided to have a short note in my pocket, my name, my father's name, my last name, and where I work. And someone close of my relatives, like my uncle and my auntie's number in that pocket, and also my blood group type.
Yeah, so blood type, it's really important to have that information in there. He said, you know, in Kabul, we have 4 or 5 hospitals, and when an attack happens, there's a lot of chaos. And, you know, information like that could really help emergency services to contact your family and tell them what has happened. And finally, I asked Dastyar what it means for him to be carrying a note like this in his pocket.
This is not a piece of paper for myself. This is my coffin I'm carrying with in my pocket, that I'm writing my name, my details, and carrying in my pocket, because no one knows when a blast happens or when a suicide attacker came from behind you.
And Dastyar was almost killed in another attack in 2014, and that's something that's always on his mind.
Yeah, I can imagine. But I gotta say, those notes alone say so much about where the war in Afghanistan is at. The World's Shirin Jafari, thank you for this update.
You're welcome, Marco.
For most of us, war is thankfully an abstract thing, something for the history books. But for those people who lived it, it's a reality every day.
The memories are so strong with me, and I think of the ghosts living in the trees. I think of the temples and the graves, and I can't go there because the spirit is there. That whole sadness is there with me.
That's Vietnamese-American journalist Nguyen Quy Duc. 50 years ago today, his entire family was swept into the war in Vietnam.
It's Tet, the Oriental New Year, and it's a new war. The Viet Cong simultaneously attacked just about every major city and town in South Vietnam. In one day, they increased the scope of the war dramatically.
That's ABC News reporting on the start of the Tet Offensive 50 years ago today. The campaign transformed Nguyen Quy Duc's life, as we'll hear in a couple of minutes. But first, how Tet transformed the entire Vietnam War. For 3 years, the administration of Lyndon Johnson had deployed increasing numbers of U.S. ground troops to try to defeat a communist insurgency backed by the forces of North Vietnam. By 1968, there were 500,000 U.S. troops in South Vietnam, mostly teenage draftees. Until that time, U.S. public opinion and the press had been reluctantly behind the war. So with the Tet Offensive, the North Vietnamese planned to show just how determined they were. Here's an excerpt from the podcast series, LBJ's War.
I really don't think in any realistic way that anybody on the top figured that they could throw 500,000 Americans into the sea.
Sam Adams was a CIA analyst stationed in Vietnam.
But I think basically what they were trying to do was jolt American public opinion right before the American elections. And in my view, they succeeded in spades in doing that.
The shock of Tet was just enormous.
Barry Zorthian was the man in charge of press relations for the U.S. military command, known as MACV in Saigon.
You know, that front page of the Washington Post that next morning with the pictures of the brand new American embassy, the old symbol of everything, not destroyed, but pretty well damaged, and dead people all around it, had to be one of the great, great, shocking, traumatic events in Washington.
I think it shows two things, Mr. President. First, that they have more power than some credit them with.
This is Johnson's Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, briefing the president the morning after the attack. His report is not encouraging.
And my guess is that we will inflict very heavy losses on them, both in terms of personnel and materiel, and this will will set them back some, but that after they absorb the losses, they will remain a substantial force. I don't anticipate that we'll hit them so hard that they'll be knocked out.
With his usual crisp command of the facts, McNamara already has a handle not only on the military side of what's happened, but on its likely political impact in the U.S.
It's largely a propaganda effort. I mentioned our people across the country this morning will feel that they're much stronger than they had previously anticipated they were. And in that sense, I think they gain.
LBJ's War is co-produced and distributed by PRI and narrated by David Brown. You can find the series at PRI.org and on iTunes. It contains some great archived tape from the aftermath of the Tet Offensive, including this moment where President Johnson angrily and profanely responds to a reporter.
I don't admit that this is a communist victory, and I don't think anybody but a goddamn communist admits it.
The communists did suffer massive casualties and were defeated everywhere, militarily. But the Tet Offensive ultimately became a defeat for America and the South Vietnamese. The American public and the press came to believe that the communists would just not quit. It would take four more years before the U.S. was able to negotiate an exit from the war. The Tet Offensive is little known among young Americans, but in Vietnam, it's still trumpeted as a major success.
I was in Hue, in the central part of the country, where the fighting was fiercest and took the longest time. And they were able to hold the city for nearly a month. They, meaning the North Vietnamese and the National Liberation Front, which was based in the south. To me, at that point, even at 10 years old, it was a shock to see North Vietnamese soldiers coming into our country. The war had always been away outside, and this was the first time North Vietnamese soldiers with a heavy, thick northern accent came to overtake the city, to give us lectures about liberating the South. And so it was a complete shock, particularly since there was a ceasefire for the Lunar New Year. And here we are having soldiers shooting everywhere.
You were more than just a bystander. You were rounded up with your family, and your father was the civilian governor of Hue. What did that mean for you and your family specifically?
Again, it was a terrible shock. And when we were in the guest house, the government guest house, we thought they were Southern soldiers. We had no idea that they had surrounded the town. And then they took all the men upstairs and then herded us, my mother and my sisters and other families, into a basement next door. And we were kept under there in the dark, both figuratively and otherwise. We had very little light.
And
we had no news. We were there for about a week and a half, and then the American soldiers and Southern soldiers came to liberate the area, and we didn't know for years where my father had been taken to, whether he was alive, killed, or what.
And what did happen to him?
Well, he was marched up the Ho Chi Minh trails and then taken to the north, where he was imprisoned in various parts of the country, and then ended up in a re-education camp. And he was held for a total of 12 years before he was released. And I didn't see him for 16 years because at the end of the war, I ended up in the U.S. And then he didn't come until 4 years after he was released. He came to the U.S.
So, Duc, when Tet is mentioned today, how do you feel? Did it define you in some way?
It definitely defined me. I became, lacking my father and anybody else, I became the morose young man who had to be responsible. I had to escort my mom everywhere. But in those first years, we didn't know where my father was. And so I was an orphan somewhat. But at the same time, he wasn't dead. We have no ceremonies for the dead. We had no funerals. We have no altars. And so you lived with this sort of grief, and you couldn't talk about it very much. And we couldn't talk about it in our house because our grandfather was living there.
That would be your father's father?
My father's father.
Yeah.
And we didn't want him to know because we were afraid my grandfather would have a heart attack. So all of us always went to the neighbors, and my mother went and cried, and, you know. And it was horrible to live without news, to not know. And then when the mass graves were discovered, that became a terrible ordeal for all of us because it was so horrible. My mom went to look for my father and saw the bodies and the mass graves, and she said, there's no way he's in there. I'm not going to go back there. It's just so horrible. I can't see it. I can't look at it.
How difficult was it to not give up hope, even in those early years when you didn't know where your father was?
You're 10 years old. You go to school and your friends would have games and would talk about normal things and you join in. And then at a certain moment, you drift away and you go back to your pain and your grief. It took years for us to adjust to it. And I don't know that I ever quite adjust to it.
So what about people in Vietnam today? How aware are they of what the Tet Offensive was and what happened during it?
It's sad that 50 years on, people don't recognize what happened. And the narrative that has always been there is that the Communist Party let the people in these wars against foreign aggression, against the French, against the Americans, against the Chinese. And it never, the government here and the party here never acknowledged that there was a civil war.
Duc, finally, when you look out across Hanoi today on this anniversary, what thoughts kind of come to mind?
Well, it's a deep sadness. There's still some anger in me that there are so many people who died, who suffered through it, who are not recognized, and that this triumphant, victorious, sort of loud pronunciations are still there. It takes away any sense of humanity from you, that you can't recognize the suffering. You only recognize the triumphs and victories, and yet not recognize that mistakes had been made, that people died, people suffered 50 years on. There's no honesty there. And that saddens me, really. And it saddens me that personally I can't even go back to Hue, even though my family still has members there. I go there and the memories are so strong with me, and I think of the ghosts living in the trees. I think of the temples and the graves, and I can't go there because the spirit is there. That whole sadness is there with me. Meanwhile, other people are coming in there, developing tourism and making money from the city without recognizing what it's gone through.
Reporter Nguyen Quy Duc speaking with us from Hanoi. Thanks so much for your thoughts.
Thank you very much, Marco, for this conversation.
Rumor has it that there's a big speech tonight in Washington, lots to listen out for, in President Trump's first State of the Union, including maybe more tough talk on North Korea. Trump has been trading Twitter barbs with Kim Jong-un of late, and that worries a lot of people because, there are nuclear weapons involved. I asked Bill Richardson about that a few days ago. The former U.S. ambassador and governor of Mexico knows a thing or two about diplomacy and about talking to North Korea.
You don't conduct foreign policy with North Korea with tweets and insults to the leader and talks like I've got a bigger nuclear button. At the same time, I don't like the president of the United States insulted like Kim Jong-un has done. I think that Kim Jong-un and the president should step aside and leave the negotiations potentially to the diplomats. I think the dialogue is the only solution, diplomacy. The first good step was the South Korean government and the North Koreans talking about some kind of human rights accommodations on the Olympics, on families. That's a start. That's what should be happening now instead of this, I'm tougher than you are, military rhetoric and talk of preemptive strikes.
Well, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists just yesterday moved their doomsday clock, which is their estimate of how close the world is to Armageddon. Last year was at 2.5 minutes to midnight, and yesterday they shaved off 30 seconds. We're now at 2 minutes to midnight. How concerned are you about the possibility of nuclear war with North Korea?
Well, I'm concerned, but I don't go for those predictions. I'm a diplomat. I'm a politician. I don't mind saying I'm a politician. I think you got to talk to people. I think both sides realize that a military confrontation is not the answer, that there's millions in South Korea that are leaving and living in great tension now. There's American troops in Japan and South Korea that would be very vulnerable. A nuclear attack, a missile attack on the Korean Peninsula It's the last thing the international community needs.
I mean, it's hard to know what the rhyme and reason is behind Donald Trump's tweets. But what about the argument that some have put forward that Trump's tweets may have actually led in a circular way to the idea of dialogue and talking?
No, I don't give them brownie points for that. I do give them brownie points for focusing more on China. I think China has leverage over North Korea. I think the Trump administration has done a good job at the UN to increase sanctions on energy, on oil, on Korean workers, on foodstuffs. I think that's the right policy. It's not going to change North Korea, but it is putting a little bite into their actions. It is pressuring them. I do commend them for that.
Former New Mexico governor and former U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Bill Richardson, thank you very much for your time and your thoughts.
All right. Thanks.
Love it or hate it, the State of the Union is the only show tonight in Washington. But there's another hot ticket in the Capitol coming up in a few weeks' time. And you can bet this guy will draw a crowd, too.
Hello, I'm James Hunter. I do a bit of singing and a bit, little bit of guitar.
James Hunter, Brit soul singer and band leader of the James Hunter Six.
And we have a new album out, and it's called Whatever It Takes. This is track one, side one, and this is the first one on the album, and this is called I Don't Want to Be Without You. And it's all about my wife.
When we met, I was pretty well set in my ways. I didn't care how or where I spent my day. But now that all has changed, I never wanna be the same. Love you so that all I know is I don't wanna be without you, baby, like before. I don't wanna be without you, baby, no more.
This record was recorded at Daptone Studios. We took 2 weeks to do that one song. And we were stuck between record deals. We hooked on Daptone because their output seemed to be in line with the feel that we were going along with. And Daptone did like us, but they'd, with possibly some reservations, but we wore them down in the end. I think we just camped on their doorstep and begged them to sign us up. Eventually they got fed up of... you know, trying to get out of it, and they agreed to it.
Oh, I sure knew when I was beaten while competing for your hand. I said, all is fair in love and war, there's nothing more to understand. Pride just set aside now that the deed was done. I said, forget her now, the better man has won. I thought I knew.
I love soul. I've always loved it. I really do. And I mean, I used to listen to a lot of that stuff when I was a kid growing up. You know, people like Sam Cooke, Jackie Wilson and the Four Tops and all that stuff like that.
When you go through a day and the things that people say,
a particular singer I found quite inspiring is Lou Johnson. He had quite a sort of muscular range, and I don't think he had quite the chart success he should have had. But we don't quite know why.
And when your jet can't accept the abuse you are taking, oh darling, reach out for me.
I think really soul music is the kind of thing that captured a lot of people in the UK, is because it's not something most of us can actually do effectively ourselves. I mean, you hear a lot of homegrown singers trying to emulate it, and the results are mixed at best, I suppose. This last cut we'd like to inflict on you is called It Was Gonna Be You.
If anyone was gonna be a guiding hand.
I wrote it under pressure from my wife, who also inspired it. It was the last one to be written, and it just scraped through, and I'm very proud of it because of how nice it came out. under duress and under time constraints.
If there was a future, I could put my dreams into. It was gonna be you.
James Hunter and the James Hunter Six there. Their new album, Whatever It Takes, comes out Thursday. Look for them soon. They're doing 8 U.S. dates in February. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for being with us.
If anyone was gonna take my heart and put it back where it belongs, if there could be anyone to reach out and pull me through, it was gonna be.
PRI, Public Radio International.